Good morning and welcome to episode 383 of Effectively Wild, the daily podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Sam Miller with Ben Lindbergh. We continue our tour of the league. Today we're going to be talking about the Cubs, and we're blessed. We get to have a discussion with both the comments writer, who is Ken Funk, and who is here with us. Hello, Ken.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Ben.
As well as Bruce Miles, who covers the Cubs for the Daily Herald and who wrote the essay, and he will be talking to Nick after we conclude with Ken. So, Ken, Ben was just saying before we came on that the Cubs are a team that he has no interesting questions about. Is there something about this team that is...
you really know how to sell an episode to everyone listening.
I just want everybody to be aware when you're stammering that it is for lack of design. Is there anything about this team that is going to be particularly interesting to watch in 2014? And I ask that because the Cubs seem to be a team that, unlike a lot of really bad teams, you're not sort of watching and waiting to see how they're going to dig themselves out of it. It seems almost inevitable that in 2016 or so, maybe a year earlier, maybe a year later, they are going to be a fantastic team. This seems like a club that has all the pieces lined up to make to make a big run at some point. They've got the front office, they've got the young talent, they've got the plan, they're doing smart things, they've got the money. And so really there's not even like this sort of interesting like, oh, well, you know, what's the character of this team going to be like? They're just going to play out this season, lose a bunch of games, and then move on to the winning. So if you're a Cubs fan, what's fun about this year?
Oh, I don't know if fun's the right word, but there's definitely interesting things about the big league club this year. As you say, definitely the future looks set, at least with the lineup. One of the questions is going to be, what are the Cubs going to do to get the pitching that they're going to need? But when you look at the Cubs in the major league this year, the two stories for me are really what happens with Starlin Castro and what happens with Anthony Rizzo. Those are the two parts of the team that are hoping, that the club is hoping, are going to be cornerstones to a certain extent going forward. They're going to be the somewhat veteran players that are going to be out there at the same time as guys like Baez and Bryant and Al Mora. And both of them struggled to a certain extent last year, especially Castro. And Castro's story is probably the more interesting one because, you know, he had come off two tremendous seasons where he was showing off his great hit tool. He had improved as a shortstop. He had had 200 hits. He had batted 300. And last year, it all just sort of fell apart. And I think, honestly, if there's one thing that led to Dale Swam not being here today, it's the story of Starlin Castro, the fact that you had this key component, the shortstop that they had signed with a long-term contract. They were working with him to try and get him to improve his approach, to be a more patient hitter so that he could hit at the top of the lineup. And that just didn't work. And there was some sniping back and forth between the organization and the player, you know, a little bit visible, a little bit less than visible. And you could see that this wore on Castro all year. By the end of the season, he basically said, I'm just going to hit the way that I want to hit. And he seemed far more comfortable. I don't know whether his results were necessarily better. In fact, the interesting thing is the point in the season when he was getting the best results is when he was being more patient, which is what the organization had been preaching. But that's really the main storyline for the Cubs this year, I think, is what happens with Starlin Castro. Is he going to be able to turn it around? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, do you get the sense that was Swaim acting on his own, going rogue and trying to remake this player in the image that he would prefer? Or was it something done with the blessing of the front office and Swaim was just the one who took the fall for it in part?
I think it was done at the behest of the front office. I think that, you know, they've been very clear about the type of, you know, patience and power sort of offense that they want to be able to develop. And they wanted to be able to have Starlin Castro bat at the top of the order. But if he's going to hit 305 with 320 on base, that's maybe not the best place for him to hit. So I think Swam was the messenger, but there seemed to be a disconnect in getting the message to him. It just didn't seem to be handled particularly well. And, you know, there may have been other issues, but from an outsider's perspective, that seemed to be the sort of the last straw for Dale Swam. But clearly it was the organization. It wasn't just Swam doing this on his own.
Are you at all surprised that there aren't more sort of trade rumors around Castro, right now? It feels like, obviously, if they traded him now, it would be selling low. But on the other hand, he still has, I imagine, a tremendous amount of kind of attractiveness about him as a change of scenery candidate. And the scenery does seem to be a source of tension for him. I mean, it really does seem like part of his issue is the tension that he's had with Chicago and with management. So why aren't we hearing more discussion about the Cubs kind of cashing him in right now?
Well, I think you touched on part of it is the fact that they would be selling low on him right now. They, you know, a year ago today, they would have said that he was a cornerstone of the franchise. It would have taken a lot to get Starlin Castro. Right now, he would definitely have some trade value, but the Cubs have shown themselves, if there's one thing they've proven over the last couple of years, it's that they know how to sell high with guys like Tom Gorzolani and Scott Feldman. You know, they bring guys in, they get some value, they pump them up a little bit, and then they treat them as penny stocks. You know, once they go up and they're worth a dollar, they sell them. So I can't imagine them selling low on Castro. But I also think that they still believe in his future. I think one of the reasons that they look at Rick Renteria as being such a good candidate to be the manager this year, why they hired him, is he's believed to be a good communicator. The fact that he speaks Spanish is something that's been sort of played up in the press, that he should be able to communicate well with players from Latin America. So I guess at some point the Cubs are going to have to look at who can they trade, who has significant value to start bringing in pitching talent, young pitching talent, because I'm not convinced necessarily that they're going to be a great team in 2015 or 2016 unless they do something to get some better pitching. I mean, they certainly have assets they can trade to do that, and they should have some money to sign players to do that. But at this point, I just don't see a rotation, and that's going to be a quality rotation in 2016. So, that's maybe what they do is they bring, if they don't believe that Castro is the long-term answer, they fix him as much as they can, and then they sell him at a higher value. But I don't think that's what they're thinking. I think that they really do still view him as a guy that they want to keep long-term.
So I was going to ask about what seems like an imbalance toward the offensive side in the farm system on our Cubs top 10, Jason Parks' rankings of the Cubs' top prospects. Their top four were hitters. 8 of their top 10 were hitters. So is this something that you think would work itself out if they didn't tinker with it? Or do you think that we'll start seeing them perhaps trade some of these guys when they're young for other young pitching? Or how do you see that playing out? How do you see them bringing that into balance?
I think that it's hard for me to picture them trading any of their big four, Baez, Bryant, Elmora, or Soler. But they have guys in the system like Dan Vogelbach, who is definitely a good hitter. I mean, he's not just a slugger. He's a big guy. He's going to be a defensive liability if he's going to play first base for the Cubs. The Cubs already have Anthony Rizzo, who they hope will have a bounce back season this year and start, you know, showing a little bit more power and a higher on base percentage. Vogelbach is a guy who could very well become a trade candidate further down the road to an American League team where he can DH. I can't imagine them trading any of the very, very top prospects, but there's enough depth in the system that there are guys that they could get some value for. Mike Olt, is hopefully going to be playing some third base for the Cubs this year. Who knows what sort of player he's going to be, having gone through the vision problems last year. But, you know, before that happened, he was a top flight prospect. There are a lot of guys that can play third base for the Cubs in the future. That might be where Javier Baez shows up. That's where Bryant's playing right now, although he might wind up going to right field. They could resurrect Mike Olt, get some value out of him for a year or two, and trade him for pitching. So I think they have a lot of options.
Would you expect to see some of those guys show up this year? Is that the thing that Cubs fans are most looking forward to as far as this season goes?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty much the only thing that Cubs fans are looking forward to this year, I would imagine. If I were to guess, I would say that we're going to see Chris Bryant and Javier Baez at some point this year, probably September. I mean, they're still, all these kids are 20, 21, 22 years old. It's wonderful when you look at the list that they're all coming up together. I'm sure this is by design, that you're going to have all these guys go through their peaks at approximately the same time so that you can build towards a championship there. There's really no need to start their service clocks any earlier than they need to. They're not ready to win now. So I think we'll get a taste of Bryant. We'll get a taste of Baez. and you know, maybe a guy like Pierce Johnson will come up, maybe CJ Edwards later in the year. But yeah, that's what everybody's waiting for, is to actually see where all these guys are going to, what they're going to look like, and where they're going to play. I mean, there's this game of positional plinko that's got to occur. You know, we have to sort out who's going to be third base. Is Bryant going to stay at third? Is he going to move to right field? That sort of thing.
Okay, so the other half of the pair that you mentioned in the beginning is Anthony Rizzo. Can you explain what went wrong with him and how complicated the fix is?
Well, I don't know how much of it was going wrong. I think he just had a down year with the bat. He, you know, he was very impressive on defense. You know, there's things to be said for that. His power numbers were down, but I don't think that he's going to be exactly what the Cubs expected. I think now you're getting a sense that he's not going to be a guy that's going to hit 35 home runs. He might be a guy that's going to hit 25 home runs. I don't think he's ever going to hit for a high average, but as his power starts to grow, as he gets a little bit older and grows into a swing, then his on-base should go up as pitchers try to stay away from him. And so I think that he's going to be a monster the way that I think Jed Hoyer at least twice thought he was going to be, having traded for him twice. I think he's going to be more of a complementary part, and you know, good enough to be a first baseman on a championship team, but I don't think that he's going to be the number four hitter on a championship team. He's going to be the number six hitter on that team.
So the Cubs payroll right now is going to be about, looks like about $85 million or so in 2014. And that's, you know, obviously that's much lower than they can handle. They, if I'm not mistaken, they can essentially afford, like, their sort of fundamentals suggest they can be like a, you know, top five or top six payroll team. So right now they're way low. So I have two questions about that. One is, the Cubs have sort of a different revenue stream than everybody else because they sell out regardless. They're not like the Astros or the Mariners where their attendance is going to drop significantly. I don't know if they have sort of dynamic pricing concerns and they charge less in years that they're terrible, if they have to charge less. But basically, the first question is there any incentive for the Cubs, in the same way that there's incentive for a lot of teams to at least put on it on a good face? Is there any incentive for the Cubs to do that, or do they basically get the same revenue regardless?
No, I think they do have some incentive. I think that it's less than other teams. I mean, if you were to compare them to the White Sox have a huge incentive to do that because even when they're going well, they don't sell the place out as much as the Cubs do. But the Cubs have seen a drop in their attendance. I mean, they drew 3 million people 2 years ago or 3 years ago. They're down to 2.6 million last year. And that's, you know, that's a pretty considerable drop from ninth in the league to 12th in the league. So that is costing them a little bit of money. But the thing is, Wrigley being a tourist destination and, you know, the joy of baseball and the sunshine and all that other happy, wonderful stuff, they definitely have a floor. You know, they're not going to go much lower than they are right now. I don't think that they would go through or have gone through an entire Astros-style teardown, but... yeah, I don't think that they want to get any better, any worse than they are now, and I think they would like to get better. There's been some grumblings. You know, if you read some of the stuff that Bruce wrote in the essay about how, you know, there's some of the sheen that's coming off of the front, Theo and Jed and Jason McLeod, you know, we know all about these Cubs prospects because we pay attention to that stuff. But a lot of Cubs fans don't, and this constant story of, you know, just wait, sort of, you know, for a lot of casual fans, they grow tired of that. And so I think that there's some anxiety about trying to show some progress in the near future, which is why I think we'll start seeing guys like Bryant and Baez at the end of the year.
So then the second part of the payroll question, so 2009, 2010, they had the third highest payroll in baseball. So when they start coming out of this, they're not going to, I wouldn't think, quite be like the Dodgers because they don't have infinite revenue the way the Dodgers seem to. But should we expect them to have a conceivably even a trade deadline like the Dodgers had 2 years ago, where they just start taking on payroll like, you know, in a way that pushes everybody else in the league around? Or given the front office that they have, given, you know, Theo's experience in Boston, where some of those contracts turned out to be really bad, do you think that that's kind of outside the character of what this front office is ever likely to do?
Yeah, you kind of said exactly what I was going to say. The experience that Theo had in Boston with Carl Crawford and Gonzalez, that I think that they're going to be a little bit more cautious about how they spend their money. I mean, we're still, the Cubs, just all they have to do is look at the checks that they're writing, because if you look at their payroll right now, the guy that's making the most money is Alfonso Soriano, who doesn't even work there anymore, right? So I think that once they start getting close, they're in an enviable position for having a reasonable payroll, a reasonably small payroll that they can go out and get players to fill in the gaps. But that's always a caution, especially when it's pitching. You know, the model that I keep thinking about with this Cubs team is the Brewers from about 5-6 years ago, when they had a similar terrific core of hitting talent with Braun and Fielder and Hart and Hardy and Weeks, who all came up together, and the Brewers didn't develop any pitching in their organization. So they went out and they started signing free agent starters, and that totally did not work. You know, they spent money on Jeff Supan and Braden Looper and Randy Wolf to try and get them into the playoffs. That didn't work. What did work twice was trading prospects for starters. You know, making the trade to get CeCe Sabathia from Cleveland helped them get into the playoffs the first year they went. Making the trade to get Zach Greinke and to get Sean Markham, that got them into the playoffs. So I think that's what the Cubs are going to have to do at some point. They're going to have to trade assets, guys like Dan Vogelbach and maybe Christian Villanueva or Mike Ohl, to the second tier of prospects, to be able to get the pitching that they need, and then smart signings beyond that to fill out the rest of the organization.
So it sounds like you're saying that Jason Hamill and James McDonald are not the answer. That is controversial.
Yeah, exactly. No, we've seen this story before. We know exactly what will happen with Jason Hamill. If he pitches well, he's going to go the way of Gorzolani and Feldman. If he doesn't, then he's going to be Scott Baker. You know, I mean, that's just the game that they're playing right now. The other signing like that, I think, honestly, is Jose Veras. Last year, they tried to pawn off Kevin Gregg at the trade deadline, and nobody bit because, you know, he's kind of not good. But Veras, you know, he might go out there and get 30 saves in the first half, you know, by the trade deadline, and he's a guy that might have some value.
Kevin Gregg might go out there and get 30 saves too. He doesn't necessarily have to be good. history has shown us. So can you bring us up to date on the Wrigley Field rooftop dispute?
I can try a little bit. I mean, mm-hmm. The only thing that I find more tiresome to talking about the rooftop debate is talking about steroids. But so the Cubs signed an agreement with the rooftop owners some years ago. The Cubs had put up a screen that had blocked their view, and the rooftop owners complained. And the rooftop owners essentially had been stealing the product for, you know, decades. So they came to an arrangement where the Cubs were getting a certain percentage of their revenue. I think that they regret signing that contract at this point. So the Cubs have this whole plan to renovate the area around Wrigleyville, to put up a hotel next to the ballpark, to put up new signage, the Jumbotron, and so forth. And anything that partially impedes the view of the rooftop owners causes the possibility of a lawsuit. So the Cubs, you know, they wanted to break ground on these improvements 6 months ago, and they haven't been able to because of the fear of this lawsuit. Now, most people think that the Cubs, if this goes to court, would win the court case, but, you know, then they kind of look like the bullies against these poor little rooftop owners in Wrigleyville, that they're not being good citizens. So actually last week, I think it was last week, they started floating again the idea of, well, you know, if we can't live with our neighbors and on the north side, maybe we'll start looking at the suburbs. Maybe we'll look at Rosemont, who had made out by the airport, which had made a pitch to have the Cubs move out there before. And that, to me, I think is making noise to try and get the rooftop owners to just come to the table. But it's just an ugly and tiresome situation, and I don't think that anyone looks good in it.
All right, so Ken, we do require you to make a prediction. We're going to ask you to tell us how many wins the Cubs are going to get this year. If you like, you may also state where that will place them in the division, but all we really require is the wins total.
Oh, I can do both, actually. So when I looked at so what I do when I try to come up with a prediction is I look at what they did last year and the changes that they've made. There are ways that you could think that this Cubs team could be worse than last year's Cubs team, in that last year they had Soriano. Overpaid as he was still a power source out in left. This year we'll have Junior Lake, maybe, who knows what kind of production you'll get out of him. Matt Garza has been replaced with, you know, the wild card of Jason Hamill. But at the same time, I expect bounce backs from guys like Starlin Castro and Rizzo to play a little bit better, continued development from Wellington Castillo. So I think that they'll improve. And, you know, I think I've settled on agreeing entirely with what Pecota is saying. Pecota has them at 71 and 91, and that's where I'm going to go as well.
Well, so you don't think there will be any rainouts that don't get made up?
Well, okay. Let me amend that. I'm going to go with 71 wins and N losses. How's that?
All right. Fair enough. All right, Ken, thank you very much. Up next is Bruce Miles with the Daily Herald. So listen to that. And we'll be back as well tomorrow with another team.
Welcome to Drop Third Strike. I'm Nick Wheatley-Schaller, and I'll be interviewing beat writers, columnists, and broadcasters from around the country, getting their perspective on the teams they cover. I'm speaking with Bruce Miles, Cubs beat writer for the Daily Herald. Bruce, how are your final days of Chicago winter going?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's been very cold here all winter. We've had snow here that's been above our heads a little bit, so anytime you're talking spring training, it's a very good thing.
Starting to perk up a bit?
Yes, it is. You know what, anytime you hear spring, even if the team you're covering is not going to be very good, which I suspect the Cubs, you know, won't be very good, you still get that good feeling about spring.
Well, you wrote the article for this year's Baseball Prospectus Annual, the article covering Chicago, and you discussed Chicago fans' feelings about Theo Epstein's first couple years running the Cubs. It's been a difficult stretch for Cubs fans as they failed to pass the 70-win mark in both of Epstein's first two seasons. The Cubs have had some excellent talent in the farm system the past couple years, but fans really want to see that results on the field in 2014. In your article, you mentioned Anthony Rizzo and Starlin Castro as two guys at the major league level who really need to have some better seasons at the plate in order to improve the sentiment that surrounds Epstein's regime. What are the Cubs looking to get out of those two players this year?
Well, that's a very interesting point, and it's a very important one, because those two players were really the centerpieces around which the Cubs' offseason revolved. Mm-hmm. They fired manager Dale Swaim the day after the season ended, and a lot of the reason for that was because they cited the communication issues between Swaim and the younger players, and you've got to read into that Castro and Rizzo. So they brought in Rick Renteria as a manager. He seems to be a very positive guy who's going to stress those positive things with these players. But they're looking for, from Rizzo, they're looking for a better batting average. They're looking for more on-base percentage from him. And from Castro, they're looking for better all-around play, all around, whether it be in the field, at the plate, in his concentration level. Again, you've got to think that they want him to approach that 200 hit level. Mm-hmm. They want him to have a better batting average and a better on-base percentage, but those are two key guys.
There have been mixed reports on Castro's defense. How do the Cubs view him as a shortstop moving forward?
You know, that's another good one, because his defense last year wasn't that bad from a standpoint of fielding the ball and throwing it. He did lose concentration several times on the field, but as far as fielding the ball, he did make an awful lot of progress out there in the eyes of the Cubs. So they still like him as a shortstop, but as all Cubs fans and all analysts know, you've got this kid named Javier Baez lurking in the minor leagues. He's a shortstop too. Somebody's going to have to move sooner or later, whether it be Castro moving to second base or third base, or Baez moving from second base to third base.
Certainly. They also have third baseman Chris Bryant, who seems to have a chance to see the big leagues in 2014. What are they looking for in Baez and Bryant in 2014? What do they want to see from them in the minors, and how could their years affect the rest of the infield this year?
Yeah, those are two very big prospects, and I've got to think that they're pretty much neck and neck right now. Even though Bryant was drafted only last year, he's really soared to the top of their list of prospects. They like him as a third baseman. They won't rule out the notion of him playing in the outfield. But I can see both of these guys coming up to the major leagues this year, and if not making an impact statistically, making an impact on the roster, whether it means Brian plays third base, whether it means that Castro moves to second and Baez moves to short. But these guys are both fast trackers.
Do you think that Darwin Barney might be the odd man out when that's all said and done?
Well, that's certainly a very valid point. Darwin Barney is a Gold Glove winner, and he was edged out this past year by Brandon Phillips of the Reds, who regained the Gold Glove. The Cubs like his defense. He's got to produce more offensively. You can't have an on-base percentage of under 300. Barney is one of those guys, to me, who would make a very nice piece on a contending team as a guy who could go in the late innings and play some defense for you. So I could see the Cubs, when these younger players are ready to come up, maybe dealing Barney to a contending team.
He could definitely be a compelling player, and not every team has the sort of infield depth coming up from the minors that the Cubs have.
No, they don't. You've got Baez, you've got Bryant, Junior Lake, who's going to start in left field for them. It's played some infield as well. So you do have some infield depth there. And let's not forget, there's a kid named Christian Villanueva, a third baseman who the Cubs maintain is the best fielding third baseman in the organization right now. He can hit with a little pop, so they're going to have to find something to do with him, whether it be use him as trade bait. Maybe he's the guy that leapfrogs somebody and comes up and plays third base. So, yeah, as you say, there is a little bit of depth there, especially at third base. And even with Mike Ault, who they got from Texas last year, third base depth that they haven't seen in years.
Yeah, they should be very happy with what their infield looks like in the future, especially if Rizzo can bounce back after last year. On a similar note, Albert Almora and Jorge Soler are the Cubs' two top outfield prospects. Almora should be able to stick in center field, and Soler looks like he's going to be a right fielder. Both those guys are more likely to debut in 2015 or later. What's their future looking like in left field? You mentioned Junior Lake is someone who's going to try left field out there. He was playing shortstop previously. What are they looking like from the future?
For right now, they're going to give Lake every bit the opportunity to play left field, to take the job and run with it after the trade of Alfonso Soriano. Mm-hmm. Lake is one of these guys with a lot of raw ability. He's got size, he's got raw power, he's got speed. He just has to harness it. So if he shows in spring training that he's mastered some of that, he could be your short-term anyway, your answer in left field while you wait for a guy like Almora in center, who is a pretty polished young player, very confident young player, and Soler and Wright, who missed most of last year with a stress fracture in his leg and who's got to really kind of play himself back into shape. The Cubs gave him a major league contract in 2012. They're still very high on him, but he needs to get some more playing experience.
The Cubs catcher last year, Wellington Castillo, he made the most of his first full season. He showcased a solid approach at the plate. He did a good job controlling the run game and blocking pitches in the dirt. The one area he really struggled in was at framing pitches. He was one of the worst catchers in baseball, according to PitchFX data. Has Castillo made any attempts to work on his receiving during the offseason?
Yes, they will do that in spring training. Right now, Wellington Castillo is recovering from late-season arthroscopic knee surgery, so that set him back a little bit in his off-season plans. But once they get to spring training later, they are going to work with him. They have a staff assistant named Mike Borzello, who works with the catchers, does a very good job. Castillo has made leaps and bounds as far as progress goes behind the plate. But as you mentioned, the framing pitches might be the last piece of that puzzle. A very good hitter for a catcher, and it's got the catch and throw part of it down, but the framing pitches is the next thing that they're going to tackle.
He did show that he could be a above-average hitter last season. Is there really any room for growth in his offensive game?
Yeah, there's some room for growth there. I think they want him to hit for a little bit more power, maybe be a little bit more disciplined. He had a very good mentor last year in Deanna Navarro as the backup catcher, who was able to work with him. This year they're going to use George Kataris, another veteran backup catcher, a guy who knows his role, and that's very important for a backup catcher, a guy who understands he's not going to play a lot, and that part of his job is to mentor the young starting catcher. So, yeah, they see a lot of room for growth, but they also see, a lot of, receptivity. Wellington is receptive to the instruction he's getting and to the coaching he's getting, which is a big plus in his favor.
On the pitching side, Jeff Samardzija had another good year after a breakout 2012 season. He headed the Cubs' rotation with some solid strikeout numbers and a career-high ground ball rate. Since 2012, his splitter has become a much better pitch. He's gotten more guys to chase it out of the zone. It led to the best whiff rate on splitters of all starters in 2013. How has he developed that pitch so well, and can he translate that success into other parts of his repertoire?
Yes, I think he can. You know, the thing we have to remember about Jeff Samardzija, even though he just turned 29 years old, he doesn't have a whole lot of experience as a major league starting pitcher. You know, the Cubs yo-yoed him back and forth, reliever, starter, minor league, major league, and his repertoire probably suffered a little bit from that, but the splitter is definitely an out pitch. I think that the pitching coach, Chris Bosio, has worked extensively with Jeff on expanding that repertoire with the fastball, with the splitter, you know, with the slider, and you know, we'll see how that develops again this year. But I think it's another year of experience. He pitched well over 200 innings last year, and the thing that doesn't always translate with the numbers, here is a guy with a tremendous work ethic who is willing to put the time in to learn these other pitches and to do the things it takes to be successful. You know, time will tell whether it pans out or not, but you know, he has a lot working in his favor.
It's definitely been good to see the way that he's been able to break out after having such a struggle, as you mentioned, going back and forth from the bullpen to the rotation. The Cubs had given him so much money when they signed him that he must have had a lot of pressure on himself.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that he was able to handle. He was, you know, a wide receiver at Notre Dame. He was risking getting his head knocked off every play going across the middle in South Bend or wherever the Fighting Irish played. So he's used to playing before the big crowds. He's used to the expectations. I don't know if the pressure got to him so much as just being such a raw talent and really being unrefined for a pitcher and really not knowing his role for 3 or 4 years. And that's really come into place the last 2 years as the new regime has taken over and given him the starting job.
So Travis Wood had a better season in 2013. He had a pretty solid year in his debut season in 2010 with the Reds, and then 2011 and 2012 fell back a little bit. What did the Cubs see? What did they see in him in 2013 that they think suggests that he could have another good year next year?
Well, I think that he's learned how to pitch, and what I mean is manager Dale Swaim always talked about arm side and glove side. He's learned to work both sides of the plate against both left-handed pitchers and right-handed pitchers. Sometimes he gets the ball up a little bit, but the wind tends to blow in quite a bit at Wrigley Field, and that helps him. It's really, many days, it's a real pitcher's park. When the wind blows out and Travis is on the mound, sometimes he gets into trouble there. But I think the fact that the Cubs like the fact that he's learned to pitch to his glove side and to his arm side against both left-handed and right-handed batters is the thing that really helped him turn the corner last year.
That's a good sign for them. We've covered a bunch about the Cubs on the field. One of the biggest topics off the field for the Cubs this year has been their contract with the rooftop owners whose buildings surround Wrigley Field. Both sides appear unwilling to give in. It's been almost some bluffing on both sides. It's hard to tell what each party wants. What is the current state of the negotiations between the two parties, and what scenarios do we think could play out over the year this year?
Well, yeah, the negotiations, I would say that they're not stalemated, but they're moving along at a snail's pace. The thing you have to remember is that there are many rooftop owners, and not all of them have the same agenda. They're not really united. Some of them want this, some of them want that. The Cubs have been hesitant to move forward on any of their renovation plans until that they are assured that they will not be sued by the rooftop owners. So they don't want to put a shovel in the ground, even to renovate the clubhouses, until they're assured that they won't be sued. So I the city has given approval. I think that the Cubs are going to try to move forward on this. They've already talked about putting up some of the signs over right field and, you know, perhaps testing the waters here to see if the rooftop owners will sue. The Cubs would like to move forward on this sooner rather than later. But the thing the rooftop owners have to remember is that their contract will end someday, and they could be out in the cold, you know, within the next decade or so. But the Cubs do have that contract. There are a lot of legalities involved. But I think somehow, some way, that this will get done and the Cubs will remain in Wrigley Field. You've heard all the talk about them moving to the suburbs. I don't think that's going to happen. I think this will get done over the coming months, and you know, they'll live happily ever after, relatively speaking, in Wrigley Field.
What is the fan opinion on this situation?
I think most of the fans here are tired of it, and most of the fans do not sympathize with the rooftop owners. It's awfully hard to sympathize from a public standpoint with billionaire owners or millionaire owners, but the most of the people in Chicago and in the surrounding area feel that if the Ricketts family, which owns the team, is willing to put its own money into the ballpark renovations without government assistance, they ought to be able to go ahead and do so. A lot of people feel that the rooftop owners have, you know, made a lot of money poaching the Cubs product, and, you know, we can get into the semantics of that, but I think most people side with the Cubs on this one.
Yeah, it's hard to see the fans feeling too bad about the rooftop owners who have just sort of started to monetize something that was once a tradition for Cubs fans.
Yeah, it used to be in the old days. When I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, the rooftops were a place where you maybe had three or four people on the roof, and they'd bring their barbecue out there and have a couple of burgers and a beer and a hot dog and watch the game. But then it turned into a big business, and then you have this whole issue of the contract between the two sides, where the Cubs are getting 17% of the revenue. So that complicates it, but again, one day this contract will be over, and the rooftops could be out in the cold, you know, if there's some sort of agreement has not come to.
So we'll go back to what we were discussing at the beginning of the interview, your article in Baseball Prospectus. What can the Cubs do this year to start to win back some of the trust from the fans for Theo Epstein's regime?
You know, I think a lot of it will have to do with the timetable that the young players have. Cubs fans are on board, I believe, for the most part, with the rebuilding program because they saw years and years of spending money and, you know, maybe winning a division title, which was all that fun, but there didn't seem to be a long-term plan. Now there is a long-term plan, so I think they're basically on board with that. The problem that the Cubs run into is they charge some of the highest ticket prices in baseball, and for the last couple of years and for this year coming, they have a team out there that really resembles a first-year expansion team. A lot of replacement-level players, some veterans, some guys who have underperformed. So it's a really hard sell for management to say, come on out and spend your 50, 60, 100 bucks plus food and all that and watch this bad product. So what I think is going to have to happen is the Cubs are going to have to start bringing these young players up, and they're going to have to show that, yes, there is some promise here. But I think for the most part, the fans are on board. But you're seeing, as I wrote in the Baseball Prospectus article, a little fraying around the edges, and it's awfully, awfully hard to sell patience to Chicago Cubs fans.
Yeah, Chicago's not an easy place to rebuild, that's for sure.
No, and especially since the Cubs have not won a World Series since 1908. Yeah, the right. White Sox won one in 2005, and, you know, White Sox fans and Cubs fans are two different breeds, and the Sox fans always like to lord that over the Cubs. So, you know, Theo and Jed can say, be patient, but Cubs fans have said, you know, our grandparents have come and gone without seeing a World Series, so it's hard to be patient.
Yeah. Well, the Cubs have some good things going for them in 2014. Thanks for coming on the show. Bruce, it's been good talking to you. Do you have anything left to say before signing off?
No, it's my pleasure coming on. Baseball Prospectus is both a fine publication, the book and the website. I think when fans look at advanced stats and things like that, it makes the game easier to understand and more fun to understand, not more difficult to understand. So dig in and have at it.
All right, well, thanks again for coming on the show, and enjoy your spring training.
My pleasure.
That was Bruce Miles of the Daily Herald. You can find Bruce's work at dailyherald.com/newsroom/Bruce Miles or follow him on Twitter at BruceMiles2112. Tomorrow I'll be discussing the New York Mets with Mark Carrig of Newsday.